It's great to have you joining us on Radio Free Georgia's In Tune to Nature program. I'm host Carrie Freeman, coming to you in April of 2024 from Atlanta in the Muscogee Creek Territory in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountain Range. Today, we're going to be talking with renowned animal ethologist Dr. Mark Beckoff about the newly revised edition of his classic book, The Emotional Lives of Animals, A Leading Scientist Explores Animal Joy, Sorrow, and Empathy, and Why They Matter. With a foreword by famed primatologist Dr. Jane Goodall, Dr. Goodall says, quote, "I'm so glad that Mark has updated his very important and popular book. In The Emotional Lives of Animals, he's pulled together the growing body of scientific evidence that supports the existence of a variety of emotions in other animals, richly illustrated by his own careful observations and conclusions. He argues forcefully that the time has come for acceptance of this body of information across the board," end quote. The chapters in the book cover the indisputable case for animal emotions, animal minds and hearts, what animals feel, wild justice, empathy, and fair play, and ends with a chapter on why animal well-being matters. I'm also happy to report that the Emotional Lives of Animals book is printed on 100% recycled paper because the publisher, New World Library, is part of the Green Press Initiative. And I wish all book publishers made recycled paper a priority. The author, Dr. Mark Beckoff, is a hero of mine who's been an animal advocate and researcher for close to 50 years. And he's a prolific author of more than 30 books on non-human animals, and I expect more books to come. A professor emeritus of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado Boulder, Dr. Beckoff has won many awards for his research on animal behavior, compassionate conservation, animal protection, and animal emotions, a field referred to as cognitive ethology. He's worked closely with Dr. Jane Goodall as co-chair of the Ethics Committee of the Jane Goodall Institute, and is a former Guggenheim Fellow. He publishes regularly for Psychology Today. He's also a vegan and avid cyclist. His homepage is markbeckoff.com, spelled MarkBeckoff. Welcome, Dr. Beckoff.
Thank you, Carrie. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's such an honor to have you on the show. Awesome.
Thank you.
Now, let me start by reading the dedication to your book. You wrote, quote, "For Jane Goodall on her 90th birthday, and for all non-human animal beings and the wonderful people who work tirelessly to give them the best lives possible, they need all the help they can get," close quote. Now, Dr. Jane Goodall really is a powerhouse scientist and lifelong animal activist. I love that you timed your book to coordinate with Dr. Goodall's 90th birthday. Can you tell us about this dedication and what it's like getting to work with her?
Yeah, it's interesting because the timing wasn't intentional in that sense, but about a, you know, you've published books, you know, about 6 or 8 months ago, I realized they were going to be coincide, although I had dedicated the book. And we started working on Jane's special birthday book about a year ago in March 2023. So working with Jane is wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean, as a person, she's every thing, if you will, every woman who she comes off to be.
Yeah.
Dedicated, passionate, positive.
Yeah.
And just really a force. I know her very well, and she's a force, and she's she's really positive. She doesn't get into these long, drawn out arguments with people.
How clever of her.
And
yeah, she manages like Dolly Parton to be liked by everyone.
Yeah. Yeah, right. I think there are people who, I wouldn't say they don't like her, but they may not like her position, but you know, she's really for her lifetime, you know, maybe not all 90 years, but she's been just really dedicated to making the world a better place for animals, humans, and the environment.
Yeah.
And that was the basis for the formation of her Roots and Shoots group. You know.
And working with kids. And you mentioned that you and Dr. Goodall are going to do a kid's book. Like, what's the theme? Is it related to chimpanzees or all animals?
Well, to be honest, we're not quite sure yet. It's going to be some kind of takeoff from the book that we did called The 10 Trusts.
Okay.
And we're not going to list each trust, but we're going to try to merge them along with a publisher into a story, if you will, about a young person working with animals, maybe elephants, and trying to help them along and take care of them and play off of the fact that a lot of animals, I mean, numerous animals, show compassion and respect and empathy for, say, members of their group, herd, brood, tribe, you know. So, yeah.
That's awesome. Well, that leads me to my question here. Your first edition of the Emotional Lives of Animals book was from 2007. What was especially important to update in this 2024 revised edition? Like, is it more evidence proving your points, or have we turned a corner into like a different paradigm of sorts in the study of animal minds?
Yeah, there's a lot more evidence. I added about 300 references.
Oh, that's awesome. And,
you know, truth be told, I resisted saying yes to the publisher a number of times.
You're like exhausted by the thought of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, you know, I mean, some second editions or revised editions are pretty much like the first, maybe a little more information and maybe, but this,
they update this, the last chapter in the intro.
Yeah, exactly. No, exactly. And stuff. So no, I really wanted to update the evidence, if you will, because I write regularly for Psychology Today. So I've been doing that, you know, in smaller or shorter articles. But this one is really, I use the word radical, but I don't really mean radical in that way. But this one really is an unapologetic breakthrough, I think, for saying we need to use what we know on behalf of other animals. There's not that, it's not a brand new message, but it's made much more strongly in this book, both with the addition of tons of research and, you know, a lot of really good stories. And somebody said, well, wasn't that your message in the earlier volume? Yeah, it was, but now it's unbending. I mean, I really mean it. You know, when I was talking to some people, one of the blurb writers and just others who had read the manuscript or the early proofs, I look at it as a breakthrough, saying we've known for centuries that animals are sentient, deeply feeling beings. I mean, we've just known that.
Yeah.
So when people say, show me the data, we've been showing you the data. Or when people say, well, we really don't know, you know, somebody not too long ago said, well, we really don't know if that dogs enjoy playing. What should I do? And I said, go to a dog park.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
Well, but, you know, from an academic, you know, so.
Yeah, okay. So,
I mean, it cuts through the chase. And even the first edition, I mean, yeah, there were some critics, but it was very well received. This one is really, really expanded and weaves together what we know into, I think, and it's a non-debatable topic.
Yeah.
It's a non-debatable, you know, position, if you will, not a topic per se, that we know other animals are sentient beings and we have to do better. And I'm tired. I mean, the last chapter is an afterword and it explains why I get cranky. And so, I get cranky because the U.S. Federal Animal Welfare Act still does not consider rats and mice and birds and fishes and invertebrates as animals. You know, they redefine the word.
And they're not covered by all what little laws protect animals who are researched on. I know I saw that theme in your book. I was glad you kept bringing that up. It is ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. So so that's where the book is different. And I really worked hard on it. I have to tell you that there were times when I almost would call the publisher and say, you know, my editor's named Jason, you know, I think this was a good idea maybe 6 months ago, but it ain't a good idea now. I'm really glad I completed it.
I'm going to cite it in my work.
Oh, okay.
I'm not a scientist that can prove all these things about animals, but I'm always talking about what we are obligated to do and what we should do and how we should talk about them. And so then I rely on these kinds of books as like the basis. And then I quickly move on to my argument, like, hey, like, let's just establish quickly in my paper that all of this has been said, that these animals, you know, feel pain. Thank you for doing all that work. And then we'll just go on. We'll move on. So yeah, I like how you feel at this point in your career and with all the evidence that you don't have to kind of convince people as much as explain it, what's there. And then what onus does that put on us? Like, move the needle forward instead of just backwards. Yeah.
Right. I mean, in the book I wrote with Jessica Pierce called The Animal's Agenda, we developed this idea called the knowledge translation gap, which is really saying we need to translate knowledge into action. I mean, that's what it comes down to. So if there was one bumper sticker for this book, that would be it. Yeah. And no more, oh, we really don't know this, or animals are acting, quote, as if they're in pain, as if they have feel joy. No, they do.
That's like a stall tactic, you know, like, oh, we don't have to make any changes because we still have to prove. It's just a delay tactic. Like, no, let's move forward.
It's uncompromising. And the argument in there too, because I really do believe it is, you know, you'll get to a point with people where you're not going to change and they're not going to change. Don't sit around for 5 years arguing with somebody who's not going to change, especially because the people like you and I aren't going to change. Yeah. So it's really saying, you know, pick your battles, if you will, pick your debates, and then just move forward. And, you know, following a lot of Jane Goodall's, you know, work on, you know, every individual matters, every individual can make a difference.
Yeah.
And empower people.
Yeah. Especially some people are going to want to, maybe they don't mind zoos, but they do mind the research. And so, like, you can get them to focus on a certain thing.
That's right.
And then, or like, they hate fur, but they like research or something. But whatever it is, there's something they can do while you and I others are trying to kind of phase out all kinds of exploitation.
Right. And working for animals, not against people. That's a really big message.
I don't need to argue with people. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it just takes
bifurcate that as like a choice and either or.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So, and I often cite your co-authored book with Jessica Pierce, the Wild Justice book, to show that humans are not the only ethical animal. And you have a chapter in this Emotional Lives of Animals book that discusses this notion of justice and fair play among other animal species. Is fairness a common trait among social animals who live in groups? And can you give us an example?
Well, I think so. I mean, you know, once again, you know, people can say, well, what do you mean by this? Blah, 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 blah. What I mean is they don't take advantage of one another routinely. I mean, they may in certain situations, just like I'm sure you and I have done, and we wish we maybe didn't. But there's certain rules of social interaction, social relationships. Like, I call them the golden rules of play. If I ask you to play with me, I'm not trying to beat you up or eat you or mate with you. And yes, there are codes of conduct and, you know, that sort of serve a social regulatory function where there's a right thing to do and a wrong thing to do.
And what do the, like, if dogs, for example, what would they do if someone violated the play rules, or they thought they were being unfair, like too aggressive in the play?
That's a great question.
Does the community regulate that individual dog who's being too rough?
Well, they might, but I'm glad you asked that question. So we collected data over, we did an 8.5 year field study on wild coyotes. And one of the big questions is, you know, among young animals is, why do they leave their group, or how do they socially interact? So it turns out, and I've seen this at dog parks, but like, imagine I'm a dog and you're a dog and I invite you to play, or a wild coyote. And the minute we play, I fight with you, or I try to mate with you, or I try to beat you up or eat you for, you know, dinner. Gosh. Then you get labeled as a, quote, cheater.
Yeah.
And others pick up through social observation what's going on. And then they might say, oh, carry a mark, they cheat. So the one thing they do is they may avoid you. And the second thing they may do is ignore your play invitations. So in the wild, the coyotes, young coyotes who do this, don't form and maintain strong social bonds. Right. So they leave their group. They're not necessarily forced out. They're ignored.
Right. And it's like being excommunicated or something, or just, yeah, which right. This is very human too, what you're describing.
Well,
because like, we're animals or mammals too. And like, we, in order to belong, you have to cooperate.
I was going to say, in order to belong, you have to cooperate and play fairly. But from a biological point of view, because I'm a biologist, is these animals who leave of their own accord suffer higher mortality. So from an evolutionary or Darwinian point of view, you don't want to leave your group. You may live, you know, as long, you may stay healthy, blah, 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 blah. But you don't want to leave your group, because then you're not going to form relationships. You're not going to have babies to, you know, increase, you know, right. maintain your gene pool. But you may suffer higher mortality. So from a biological point of view, you know, cutting through the chase, if you will, there's strong selection.
Right.
Being fair, cooperative, just, moral, whatever word you want to use.
Yeah.
And we're finding that in so many different species. It's unbelievable. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of people probably understand intuitively that mammals, like we were discussing, and birds are sentient beings, acknowledging to some extent their intelligence, emotions, and family lives. But have we learned new insights into species that people may underestimate, like insects and reptiles, that might make us respect them more?
Yeah, I mean, we tend to see those same patterns, like in mice, rodents, who are routinely mutilated in research.
Ugh.
Yeah. We see fairness in fishes, for example, and empathy and cooperation.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you really look at what's going on out there, and it's easy to ignore by people who are speciesists to say, well, fishes can't do that. Yeah, they can. You know, they have, and they also have very unique personalities where you might expect a certain behavior or behavioral profile coming from an individual who you would label bold, shy, fair, just. Yeah.
So that's also an important point, that just like in human culture, we might be Homo sapiens, but we're not all going to act the same. So like not all salmon or not all butterflies and not all coyotes are going to act the same.
Yeah. Absolutely. And one of the major messages in the emotional lives of animals in a lot of work I do is that, it weaves itself into compassion and conservation, is every individual counts, the life of every individual matters, and there are major individual differences even among littermates. When we studied young coyotes, they came out of the ground like at, you know, what, 21 days of age, and they were bold animals, shy animals, obnoxious animals. And, you know, that's what motivated a lot of our field research, was how did those play out over time? So
they then have their own relationship in the group too. And if one gets shot or removed, the whole family might have relied on that individual for something. And you can see, and I was also enjoyed reading Rick McIntyre's books about the wolf in Yellowstone, and that he really paints a picture too of the various personalities, even between sisters and siblings, like you're talking about. And I mean, you get really attached to them, and you're like, that gal's mean. And the, and so it is the dramas they have are kind of remind me a lot of our own dramas. So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was one of the things that really surprised a lot of my students, was that these young coyotes, I mean, at 21, 3 weeks old, like if you've seen a 3 week old dog, were vastly different behaviorally.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you asked that question, because individual differences really focus once again on the value of each individual's life. And that's basically, that's the foundation for compassionate conservation, that it doesn't matter if there are a million brown rats. It doesn't, because there's a million brown rats, you can't just kill 1,000 because their lives don't matter.
Right. If like a lot of the old school conservation would just treat the whole species and they don't care about the individuals, and they're just trying to have supposed health of the entire species or ecosystem, like doing things that are completely unjust and cruel to the individuals within that. And I feel like we try not to do that in human society. I say try. And so I feel like we should offer the same courtesy. That's what compassionate conservation is to me too, like offering a similar courtesy of respect to the individuals who live freely, you know, not to just murder them because we've decided their numbers aren't right.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And it gets tricky with some people, but you know, the way I cash it out is typical classical conservation plays the numbers game. Well, there's a lot of carries out there, so you don't count as an individual. There's a lot of marks out there. You don't count. And I always say, if somebody said to me, well, you know, there's a lot of marks out there, you know, meaning they look like me, they act like me, so you don't count, you know, so we're going to kill
Get
you.
Rid of you. Yeah.
And I, you know, my response is no, thank you.
Yeah. Oh, do I get a vote in this? Because I say no.
Oh, yeah. So. Do I get a vote? Do I get a vote in this? So,
well,
yeah.
For those just joining us on Radio Free Georgia, this is In Tune to Nature. I'm host Carrie Freeman, talking with animal behavior expert and University of Colorado Emeritus Professor of Evolutionary Biology, Dr. Mark Beckoff, about the newly revised version of his classic book, The Emotional Lives of Animals, A Leading Scientist Explores Animal Joy, Sorrow, and Empathy, and Why They Matter. The book is printed on 100% recycled paper. His website is markbeckoff.com. That's spelled markbeckoff. So his first name ends with a C and his last name contains a K. Dr. Beckoff, the end of your, we already mentioned a little bit about this, but the end of your book is Ethical Choices, Why Animal Well-Being Matters. That's the final chapter. And I really love it when books end with a purpose and tangible solutions. So what were some of your recommendations in this Ethical Choices section?
Oh, God, there's so many, but
there's a lot, right? So because you have ones for researchers and zoos, you go through a lot of the ways animals are exploited. Well, one thing, how about this? Let me ask you this question.
No,
you did promote animal well-being rather than just animal welfare. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that was interesting. What's the advantage of the term well-being as opposed to welfare?
Right. And that's a good question. So animal welfare really is based on, you know, this utilitarian calculus. If the costs outweigh, if the benefits outweigh the costs, it's okay to do something. So it's usually humans deciding what the benefits are for humans and the costs for the animals. And usually, you know this as well as I do. Somehow they come up saying, well, the benefits to humans outweigh the costs to the animals, so we can use a million mice to study or develop a drug that won't have any benefit for humans. So
help one human in theory. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And it doesn't focus on individuals. So the reason, I mean, really, the one of the main reasons, I guess there were a couple, that Jessica Pierce and I wrote The Animal's Agenda, was to develop the science of animal well-being versus the science of animal welfare. Because the science of animal welfare just looks at species once again. So, you know, you can, a company can produce a million mice, you know, 99% of whom are gonna be tortured and abused and then killed in research. And they'll say, well, we can keep making mice. No. Well-being says the life of every individual mouse matters. I have been for years, but even more so now, whenever I write or if an editor changes well-being to welfare, I write back and say, no, you can't do that because they're distinctly different things. And
because I was just talking to somebody about this, that also I feel like the word well-being is has less baggage around it than welfare. Because I think really what we're doing in the environmental movement and really the human rights movement, the animal rights, everything, all the movements are about well-being. Like that is the core. You could also say health. That's another way to describe it. But well-being is a little more well-rounded of a word. And then also like animal welfare is attached to a certain corporate or even institutional rules, like you were mentioning.
Absolutely.
There's an animal welfare policy that means I use these animals, but I abide by certain rules to reduce their suffering to some extent while I still kill them or something.
Well, I'm not surprised given what you do and how articulate you are. That's precisely Right. And then sometimes when I'll say the science of animal well-being or animal well-being, people will ask, why are you using that word? And the word welfare, you know, when you think about how it's applied to humans, when people are on welfare, it's because they're down and out and they need help, money, food, health. And so, yes, we can say the same about a lot of non-human animals. They're down and out. But I don't like to and then, of course, the implication among humans, or maybe not 100%, is that these are people who are poor, they're members of marginalized groups. You know, there's too many shades of, I don't even know what the word
it's
would
been,
be.
Right. It's been politicized in a negative way. Helping out others has become like, it's a government handout or waste of taxpayer dollars, or people are cheating or whatever. But even though the whole intention of it is to help others, like meet their needs. But so maybe the word welfare is fine. It's just that in our society, there's too much baggage around it now, and it means something different than what it should. So well-being is I really like this. And so I'm probably going to be using that word more and more myself to well-being.
Well, what you just said is exactly right. Oh, we're giving people a handout. No, we're not. When we treat non-human animals with respect, dignity, compassion, we're not giving them a handout. We're treating them as they should be treated.
Yeah.
And I like what you know, the way you cast it out, you know, that among humans, it, you know, suggests that, well, we're giving them a handout because they can't make it or something. Or they, yeah. I mean, really, and you know as well as I do, there's all the socioeconomic clouds over welfare and all that, you know, and no, it's not a handout. We are treating them with respect and dignity and compassion and kindness because they deserve it, each and every individual, not as a handout. You know, we're not being gratuitous. We're saying your life matters. And I don't care if there's a billion white mice or, you know, monkeys in the labs. Your life counts.
Yeah.
And we are obligated to treat you with respect, dignity, kindness, compassion, fill in the blank.
Yeah. Well, and to wrap up, Dr. Beckoff, what can our human listeners do with this understanding that non-human animals are much more cognizant and emotional than we've given them credit for? Like, what onus does that put on us now that we know we've been underestimating them and causing them to suffer? Mm-hmm. Like, what do we do about that?
Well, I think the main message is decide what you're passionate about, say within the field of animal protection, animal well-being, and do something.
Yeah.
You know, people will say, oh, you know, I'm busy. I can't found a movement. I don't have a lot of time. It doesn't matter. Do something. I mean, I really just do something. And there's a line in, I've used it elsewhere, but in the book, and it was picked up by a reviewer recently. It's like, never say never, ever. Just don't give up. It's hard work. You know that. I mean, you know, you can work really hard and get zero out of it. But
right. Or you don't get, you try to get some referendum passed and your community doesn't work or whatever.
Yes. So move on to something
like
else.
It's still worth it, even when things don't go our way, to show other people that we think these individuals are being mistreated and we should do something differently. Like that this is controversial. I think it's good, just even the notion that we have vegetarians and vegans shows everybody that the standard diet that we've excused doesn't need to be. It's not nutritionally necessary and it's harmful, so that we can move in a different direction and still thrive. That eating animals is not uncontroversial.
Right. And no, I totally agree. And, you know, you just have to, it takes a lot of time and energy and belief, and you might just bump from one project, you know, to another. And the other thing I always say is, don't expect a gold star on your forehead tomorrow. You know, there might be immediate gratification sometimes. It may be delayed, and you may not even, quote, be around. I mean, you think of what Jane Goodall is doing, you know, and I'm not saying it in any kind of negative way. You know, she's 90 years old. I would love that she would just survive, out-survive me and you and everyone else. But, you know, there might be a time when she or others just can't do something. But don't be so goal-directed. It's nice to achieve something, but don't let that be your motivation. You know, it takes a long time to pass, you know, formal legislation, regulations, and guidelines for how animals can be used and abused. Excuse me, how animals can be used and abused in different situations.
Yeah. And I think we could try to be thinking about not only companion animals in our communities, but also domesticated animals who are farmed and how we could be helping them with our dietary choices. And then the wild or free animals around us. So there's like different categories of animals that we could do different changes in our life to just pay more attention to them.
Yep.
How we're, even if we're saying individually, I don't want to do something that's impacting negatively on the squirrels or the raccoons or the coyotes in my neighborhood or something.
Well, there's a group in Denver, since I live in Colorado, just a group of citizens who are working their tails off to get rid of puppy mills in Colorado.
Wow.
And
great.
They are,
yeah.
You know, I really, really like grassroots activism. So these
yeah, they're not part of a mainstream and like 501c3, they're just people who are like, nope, we're not having this in Colorado.
We're not going to have this. They, you know, most of them have full-time jobs, and I love working with them. And it's amazing what they get done in addition to full-time jobs, being parents, having other obligations and responsibilities to do. So I like the grassroots one. But to me, I just say, find something about which you're passionate. I don't care if you're the only one, you know, just... You know, that
a lot of people really like songbirds, or they're really into dogs, or, you know, or they're into health. And so they could do stuff with veganism or
yeah.
There's always something, because right, it's more sustainable if you pick something that you like and that fits with your personality, and you can make more of a difference in that one area. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you're doing something, I mean, I've been fairly high-end athlete for years, and training for bike racing and other things is really painful. But the reason I use it as an analogy, or writing a book, as you know, you've done it, can be really painful. But you have this goal out there. It's not, I mean, it could be a tangible goal, but sometimes you go rapidly towards it. Sometimes you go rapidly away from it. Sometimes you don't go anywhere. You just sort of sit there going, oh, what the hell am I doing here? But it's persistence and belief. And so I always say to people who are working as animal activists, if you will, radicals, which I think is dumb, you know, there's nothing
radically
radical.
Kind.
Yeah, it's radical to be kind, right? But just go for it. You know what I mean? You can have your good and bad days playing tennis or on your bike.
Eventually riding, probably get there. Yeah.
But you, right. And you won't get there if you let people say, oh, that's useless, or, you know, derail you, you know. So I always, and I've really worked that way, is you focus on some kind of long-term goal. It's tangible because it's out there, but it's a belief. I mean, it's a belief.
That's motivating to us. Having that keeps us going.
Exactly. And so it can't be result dependent. I mean, every now and again, you know, you could sit back and go, what the hell am I doing here? I mean, I'm not getting anything done. But you are getting things done. You're among my friends, you know, they'll say, why are you doing that? And I'll just tell them why. And it's changed some of them, you know. So I think that it's just, you know, it's just a belief. And like, you know, Jane Goodall always says, it's just, you know, there's so many reasons for hope. That was a book of hers.
So positive. Well, we really do need that, because that's an important part. And you know, as a teacher, like I am, that when we're trying to tell all our students about all the problems in the world and that they need to work on, and we have to discuss the solutions and the political will to make those solutions happen, or else we leave the students feeling apathetic and overwhelmed and drained. Which, so there's like in writing a book, you have to walk that line too. between saying, oh, we're really being so destructive and cruel towards other animals, but we don't have to be. We can do this. We can phase out farming and research and zoos and all these things. And what
I know we're getting towards the end, but it could be, just really, to me, it was a really valuable lesson because I do work with Jane Goodall's Roots and Shoots group, and I'm very positive with kids. And this little girl, eighth or 10 years old, actually came up and said, thank you for being positive and thank you for giving me hope, because I use the word hope a lot. And so we had this little talk. I mean, I could have been talking to an adult. She said, a lot of people she talks to are so negative.
Oh,
you know, the world sucks. We're mistreating animals. And she's saying, among her friends, they're saying, well, why should we get involved in something, where there's no positive outcome? There used to be this, I think it was a TV show or a book, kids say the darndest things.
Yeah.
I left and I knew her teacher personally. And I said, I can't remember her name now. I said, she gave me a new view on life and the importance of being positive, because she said, why should I'd rather go play in the playground or go ride my bike or do something than work for animals and the environment. But you're telling me, she said something like, you're telling me that even if it looks dismal, there's hope.
Yeah.
Because she said, why should I work on something that you and other people are giving up on? I mean, the logic was impeccable.
Yeah. I think that, because otherwise we could all just be hedonistic and just use up all the what little resources there are left and have a big party as on our way out. As we drag all the other species with us, that's the other option, but I don't like that one.
No, I don't like that one either, but just find what you love to do. I mean, and do it, as long as it doesn't mean harming people or non-human or human animals in their homes. But I really think that personally, that's how I grew up with my folks. And, you don't know how things are going to play out over decades, but one of them is persistence and belief. Just don't let people take, Jane says, follow your dreams. Yes, follow your dreams. It's okay. I mean, of course, as long as they're positive dreams, but
not totally self-centered.
Right, exactly. Get away from yourself. It's not all about you. It's not all about you. It's not all about us as humans. Just get away from that.
Exactly. Well, that's the end of our show, but I want to thank you, Dr. Mark Beckoff, for being with us on Radio Free Georgia's In Tune to Nature program. Thanks for the nonstop research you've done for decades as a scientist to get other scientists and the general public to acknowledge the truth that other animals are fellow sentient beings worthy of our respect.
Thank you, Carrie. What a pleasure.
Thank you. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in Tune to Nature, podcasting every Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time, online at WRFG.org and on Atlanta radio station 89.3 FM. We post action items, news, and podcasts on the show's website, facebook.com/intunetonature. The views and opinions expressed on the show do not necessarily reflect those of WRFG, its board, staff, or volunteers. I'm one of those volunteers. I'm host Carrie Freeman, asking you to please support independent, non-commercial media like Radio Free Georgia. And remember to take care of yourself and others, including all these other species with emotional lives like ours. Thank you for listening. Cheers.